The probability of precipitation today is 20% tonight. And with me now in the studio is Tom Rich, a researcher with Bob Marshall, who frequently appears on CKLN. He's been on a holiday in the recent few weeks, and he is back to tell us what he thinks is significant about 1985. Tom?
Well, thanks very much, Dave. I welcome this opportunity of being present, actively present all around the globe. I've been spending the last year as a news researcher, as you mentioned to the listeners, with Bob Marshall, and we felt that with the year coming to an end, a very important year for news, that we would do a brief summary, not of the entire spectrum of the news, but that we would take a look at what we felt from the international connection point of view was the most important stories to ripple the surface. Now, this really was the biggest year in the news for the international connection. And to begin with, May Brussels' focus on the news was proved valid and accurate as President Reagan went to Bitburg to honor the Waffen-SS dead who had been commanded by General Fritz Kramer, who Brussels had been trying to reveal publicly as being not only Hitler's top general in the Battle of the Bulge, but also Henry Kissinger's mentor. Brussels, who was like a Solzhenitsyn of the West, has been researching the major participating role which the ruling elites take in political assassinations around the world. I might add that Bob Marshall was directly responsible for putting Frank Zappa in touch with Brussels, who has since provided her with a computer as a gift for helping him to testify before the U.S. Senate on the issue of censoring music videos. The next biggest news story of 1985, which we reported back in June, was the revelation of how Venice plans to rule the new Yalta deal, bringing about the new dark ages. As was documented in depth this year on the International Connection, the new Yalta deal has been the prevailing doctrine of the State Department since Henry A. Kissinger's tenure there. More details about new Yalta plans were aired by Zbigniew Brzezinski on October 6 in an op-ed in the New York Times. He made it evident that it is purely a stratagem for agreement between empires. The new Yalta deal stipulates that the U.S. would recede to 25% of the world it commanded in the 1970s. The U.S. influence is to be circumscribed within the Western Hemisphere. Western Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia are to be ceded to Moscow. The new Yalta is working, William Sullivan, former ambassador to the Philippines and Iran, explained. And the way it's working, he said, is through bilateral discussions which officials of the State Department have had over the last year with their Soviet counterparts. The negotiators have been Assistant Secretary of State for the Middle East and Southwest Asia, Richard Murphy, and Soviet Deputy Foreign Minister Vladimir Polyakov. The new Yalta crowd has worked for years for the decoupling of Western Europe from the United States and the reassignment of U.S. troops stationed in Europe to Central America. I think this is something that we can watch for in the few months, early months of 1986. The bilateral talks between the two ruling oligarchies of West and East have functioned as the means by which the rules have been set to avoid superpower confrontation under conditions in which both parties are destabilizing targeted nation-states of the underdeveloped sector, such as Central America, South Africa, the Philippines, and elsewhere. So these stories, which we see rising to the surface in the news and gets a lot of play on the air, are something which takes place and are masterminded long before below the surface. Ever since the era of Charlemagne, when humanity began to pull itself out of the mud of the Dark Ages, the gravest danger to Europe's noble families has been posed by the nation-state, with a leadership committed to the development of its citizenry and its economy. Judging from the events of this year, it is obvious that the world is in a very sorry state. The people are frantic, yet tired beyond anxiety. One could joke that they live with a Sodom of authorities and a Gomorrah of citizens. Today, people around the world watch the news in order to enhance their identity. However, it seems as we move deeper into the post-industrial age, where events are made and recorded at instant electric speeds, that we continue to lose our identity. What is the process here that is going on? I want to put to bed once and for all this whole issue about powerful conspiracies. We as Canadians especially should be ashamed of ourselves if we write off their existence. We need only look to our southern borders to find the answers we seek. As Benjamin Franklin, who was the Sir John A. Macdonald of America, documented in his autobiography, the United States was created by a conspiracy subsuming Franklin's own junta network. Even Cambridge-trained British agent Charles Beard complained in his book that it was a conspiracy centered in the Society of Cincinnatus, which completed the work of developing the United States as a federally constitutional republic. But this was not a U.S. conspiracy. It was a transatlantic conspiratorial collaboration among the Commonwealth Party and the forces identified with Colbert and Leibniz on the European continent. It was these networks of conspirators led by Franklin, which worked from within France, Russia, Spain, and Germany to maneuver those nations' national policies to support the American cause. How often today are entire nations guided by men who are in power only because of their ability to delude and deceive their own people? By means of clever propaganda, the leader makes the people believe what he himself knows to be a big lie. As long as supposedly educated leaders, Dave, keep deceiving themselves and others about the existence and power and plans of our real rulers, our civilization is doomed.
Thank you, Nelson. Obviously, what you say and what you've been saying through the whole year will raise eyebrows, and does raise eyebrows, but I think we have to give you credit for what you have done. Tom, for instance, when you interviewed the chap from EIR recently, what happened afterwards was that the man he had named during the interview was the person that the RCMP arrested.
Yeah, that's right. Bob Marshall and I interviewed back in early September chap from the EIR by the name of Joe Bruda. And he divulged suppressed information to us that Talwinder Singh Parmar, who was a Sikh terrorist leader, was enjoying free travel rights within Canada to openly organize for the assassination of Prime Minister Gandhi. And now it wasn't until 2 months later that the RCMP laid charges against that individual as well as others. Joe Bruda is only one source, the Executive Intelligence Review, one source of many that we use. We don't put any one source up as a gospel, but we do find that there are a number of very important key sources who, like the Executive Intelligence Review with this Sikh business, also with many other stories that they came out with in 1985, they were way ahead of the popular release of the news, and because they really follow what really seems to go on in the below the surface.
Okay, 11:22 on CKLN. Nelson, you started your editorial today with Tom. I'm sorry, I keep thinking of Rockefeller. Anyways, I got Rockefeller in mind. We'll get to that soon. You spoke of Bitburg. And you opened up your speech today with Bitburg, and that was relevant. I think a lot of things have come out with it. This was the year for Nazis, and the clear the announcement, for instance, that the search for Nazis was called off in 1948 because of the Cold War, the Deschenes Commission in Canada, the destruction of the file shortly after Rauco was extradited. All this, I think, raised once and for all into the public's mind that, yes, you know, a lot of the things that May is saying about the Nazis, about how they are favored by the intelligence communities, this is true. The Bitburg thing was highly relevant. There's so many examples that emanate out of the Bitburg thing that then make a lot of sense. For instance, Helen Von Dahm, President Reagan's secretary in California. She was previously the secretary of Otto von Volschwing. Who was Otto von Volschwing? He was Eichmann's higher-up, who supervised the mass killing of Jews in East Europe. why is she the president? Why is she President Reagan's secretary? And then she later became the ambassador to Austria. Is that correct? And then had to resign after the scandals broke out.
Well, of course, the important process going on here behind the scenes is basically, I think, what I mentioned, Fritz Kramer, and why that made Brussels important. And that's because Fritz Kramer, who was Hitler's top general at the Battle of the Bulge, after the war, was brought by the Dulles Group back to the Pentagon and was in charge, had the title Army Plans Officer of the Pentagon. Now, the Nazi thing comes really close to home. Even recently, in November 15th, Swiss Nazi banker Janoud withdrew a libel suit to cover his terrorist ties. And Janoud and his lawyer, a man by the name of Bonant, was suing Le Monde and L'Express and a number of other newspapers. And when it got to the fact that the court was going to be asking Janoud to bring out certain Nazi connections that he had, and it came out in court, he immediately withdrew his libel suit. He was the plaintiff in that, not the defendant. And it's interesting that his lawyer, Bonant, his clients include Lucio Gelli, the former head of the subversive Propaganda 2 Freemasonic Lodge, and a veteran of Mussolini's secret police agency. And when you look at the people, which Bob Marshall shows, you look at the people that May points out, they all seem to have these shadowy figures around them who they socialize with, who they do business with, who their offices are together with. And, of course, this is the important connections that we must watch for today in order to find out the patterns.
Also, we should point out the nepotism involved in continuing these the connections. For instance, with Fritz Kramer, a Pentagon plans officer, former Hitler's general, his son is Sven Kramer, who is Sven. Well, Sven is Reagan's presidential advisor. He is implicated as being behind the team that stole Carter's speech before that famous 1980 television debate. He's now presently National Security Advisor, and we can only guess how much of the values he holds that his father held and that allow him to get into the positions he can.
Well, 1985, certainly, as you mentioned, all these events are very indicative of a pattern of movements within a group of people who are below the popular level, who are definitely well-organized, able to communicate with each other, able to send money around the world to each other, able to foment violence wherever they want. And with this recent terrorist incident in Vienna as well as in Italy, it's just, I think, the forerunner of much more to come. I think that we should look for in 1986. Anybody, of course, out there who's watching the news would obviously say, well, it's easy to predict violence and more terror. There's no doubt that that's going to continue. The real question is how significant are the weapons going to stay? Will they remain with the present weaponry, or are they going to increase? I think the real thing that a man by the name of Wilson, who's in jail today, in his interview with Penthouse, Edmund Wilson, talked about the atomic weapons that the terrorists have easy access to. So what are we going to be doing when the terrorist walks into London, Heathrow, or into JFK Airport with an atomic weapon in his briefcase? These are the things that we must look forward to come, and they are coming.
We could continue with this, but what I'd like to do is you spoke of the relevance of the Geneva Summit and the New Yalta Agreement in Vienna. Now, this term, New Yalta Agreement, again, raises a lot of eyebrows with listeners. In fact, they probably think that you're getting your news from a wire service.
Well, I quoted it right out of the New York Times, so it's not as if it's a term which anybody who's reading the major papers would be aware of it. Definitely the major television news outlets do not really talk about it at all. And that's another interesting issue as to why they don't discuss it. But there's no doubt that the major empires come to an agreement, and the summit was really the icing on the cake to the agreement which was worked out. long before Reagan and Gorbachev did get together. Now, on the western side of the oligarchy, you have Lord Carrington and Henry Kissinger, his consultant, who are very, very big in these sorts of talks. So on these top levels, these guys like Kissinger and Carrington and others are very much involved day to day in these negotiations. And the public is not readily or regularly informed about it. And this is not any result of that the information is restricted. It's just that the major TV media doesn't play it up.
Now, the previous Yalta Agreement can be summarized as being a division of the world into spheres of influence.
Right.
How does this one differ?
Well, this doesn't differ as to the... it divides the world. It just it's just a renegotiation of the past Yalta Agreement, taking into account that that the East has gained in strength and the West has lost in strength. The Soviet Union is... very close to installing a strategic defense initiative, their own SDI, not to cover their entire landmass, but to cover the greater Moscow area. Now, while on one hand they prepare and set up an SDI to cover the greater Moscow area, likewise they also move towards trying to lobby through our media to talk about how if the Americans go ahead with an SDI, that it's going to be a threat to war and can be used as a first strike weapon. Well, really, it's a war of words and a war of icons, and it's very difficult to tell and see through the thick maze that's going on there.
Now, some of the other terms you use that maybe we should define, Nelson. Tom, I keep doing this. I'm sorry. You said that news enhances identity.
Well, I said that people look to the news and listen to the news in order to enhance their identity, because under electric conditions, we now really are a collective body more than we were with print, especially today under electric conditions of instant information movement. And so people look to the news regularly in order to get an idea of where they fit in and what their own identity is. And I said that even though they read the news and they're always watching the news day in and day out and keeping up on it, to enhance their identity, the paradox is that really we continue to lose our identity. And that's basically what I was talking about, that paradox that exists there. It seems that, like with terrorists, are they committing the event for the publicity, or are they committing the event because they actually want to kill the people?
Now, when you say loss of identity, the paradox, do you mean the homogenous aspect of the news, that it tells people what to think about, what to focus on, what are the issues?
Well, I mean loss of their own private identity, and i.e. as to where they fit into the society and what their goals and objectives are going to be.
You mean the identification instead comes with things that are almost discarnate from the actual self?
Yeah, that's partly right. I think that what I mean is basically, when I say identity, is I mean what you basically understand by the word when you hear it. The people require an identity, and as we lose our identity, we have to gain it only through violence. Violence is the only way of enhancing and increasing our identity. These groups in the Middle East and elsewhere that are receiving both the phonetic alphabet at the same time that they're getting electronic technology are very much in a point of confusion, and they don't know in which way to turn.
Post-industrial age, would you like to define that for us?
Well, David Peterson used it within the last 3 weeks. I guess we should ask him to call up to the show. He should be listening, and ask him what he meant by post-industrial. But certainly post-industrial, as we use it, is very much linked to the idea of the new dark ages, and that is that industrial society was ushered in with the invention of steam and mechanical devices and printing and the printing press, and that gave a new way of doing things, increased manufacturing, and as a result, people left the feudal lands and went to the cities and towns and went to the towns then, and then eventually towns and cities were created, and the feudal period died out, and we moved into an industrial age and eventually into a super-industrial age. And today, under electric conditions, we're moving away from the industrial age and into a post-industrial age, and therefore we should see all those icons that are natural to a feudal period start to rise up, such as emperors and kings and queens, and the governments and nation-states, which didn't exist before the industrial age, will tend to disappear and fade away quite rapidly.
Quickly, to signify the new Yalta Agreement, what developments should we watch, and what developments, even in this newscast, could you say, did you hear today's news?
Yes, I did.
Okay, what developments?
Well, the first major development, of course, has happened, and that was the summit. At the summit, the new Yalta deal was to be signed. I think that the major movement that's happening as a result of the new Yalta deal is exactly what's happened with this increased terrorism. I think we're going to see increased terrorism not only against the change will be not only the terrorism against the United States and Israel, but we're going to start to see more terrorism against the Soviet factions as well. We had a recent Soviet kidnapping of Soviet citizens in Lebanon, and you're going to start to see that begin to escalate.
Now, what about the role of the Soviet Union in the Middle East? It appears Jordan is now warming relations with Syria. Egypt will possibly follow suit. How is Israel going to respond?
Well, first of all, the agreement, the new Yalta deal, and the crowd that was behind it, their basic doctrine is to decouple Western Europe and the United States. So you will shortly see U.S. troops pulled out of Western Europe. Now, Soviet hegemony has already moved into Israel. Israel has a very high debt, and already Mr. Bronfman earlier in the year went over to Moscow and cut a deal with him. What the deal is, we don't have all the details. The Executive Intelligence Review has released some, but it's still too early to tell. But there's no doubt that generally there has been an agreement. There'll be an by March, the Soviet Union will recognize and set up diplomatic relations with Israel. And pretty well what this means is you will start to see less of an influence that the United States will have in the Middle East, and that will cause quite a problem.
Now, when you talk about a lessening influence of the United States in the Middle East, Tom, I'm wondering if they've been ceded Central America and South America, which is really already their turf, what's going to happen with independent revolutions? Are we going to see incredible suppression with Moscow turning a blind eye? You know, if I, you know, in Nicaragua want to defend myself against the United States, are the Soviets going to still sell me arms, or are they going to stop selling me arms because they're going to say, I'm sorry, you know, we can't get involved? Like, is it that clear-cut, or is there still that general battle spheres of influence with possibly the Soviet Union? No, I don't want to say gaining an edge, because I personally look at the situation in Nicaragua and places like that as a condition of the U.S., you know, wants to attack them and won't sell them arms, and they're fools not to go to anyone else.
Well, you must remember, first of all, that now that a deal has been cut between the Israelis and the Soviets, and we'll see a greater Syria. Syria has, Israel has allowed and has cut a deal also with the Syrians that they will let the Syrians and Syrian-sponsored troops escalate their troops into Lebanon in return for leaving the Golan Heights alone. Now, a chap by the name of Yevgeny Primakov, who's head of the Soviet Oriental Institute, which is a large Soviet think tank, denounced an agreement between King Hussein of Jordan and Yasser Arafat and attacked Arafat personally. I think that as a result of agreement cut between the Soviet Union and Israel and Syria, you're now seeing the major body of the PLO under attack by the Soviets, as well as Israel. So the Soviets and Israel now have a common enemy. And I think this is also what's adding to the problem in Western Europe today. And this is what split the PLO faction and what has caused the problem for Arafat, because he no longer has the support of the Soviet Union that he had once banked on.
Possibly beneath the scenes, still in the Soviet news, in that it definitely reflects a support for the PLO, so maybe underneath the scenes, but I don't think fully yet in terms of the Soviet Union has not distanced itself from the moderate faction of the PLO, and I still think that they look at them as a legitimate organization, representation of Palestinians. What do you think, Tom? Do you see that?
Well, I think that basically the details of what a new Yalta would actually look like in the regions that you're talking about, in truth, the whole deal emerges when it emerges in its full starkness. New Yalta is another name for Russian imperial domination of the globe.
Okay, it's 11:40 on CKLN. We're moving along. I got to cut you short, Tom. Okay, we're going to go into two stories that I think are really important, and I'm sure you'll agree, the Ross Dowson ruling and pollution. Pollution, very important story in 1985.
Certainly.
Let me first just quickly round up some of the developments. East Coast, okay, you've got the Ganja incident. You've got Richard Hatfield, the marijuana being planted in a suitcase, or so he says. The Titanic being found. Okay, there's your East Coast. In Quebec, we have the defeat of the PQ, the rise of the Liberals again under Bourassa. Of course, Bourassa himself doesn't get elected. He has to run in a riding to gain a seat. You've got the PCBs in Hydro-Quebec, also very important. In Ontario, you've got the fall and rise of the Blue Machine. I mean the fall under Miller and the possible rise again under Larry Grossman. We don't know. We've got the NDP Liberal Accord, very important. The Blue Jays almost take the series. The de Havilland sale, very important. The Zundel trial, very important. The Armenian subway station incident, as you recall, set us into an almost a wartime mode. The tornado in Barrie, important. The baby deaths, unsolved. Those are definitely some of the Ontario stories. In the prairies, the drought. In Manitoba, the abortion clinics, the Morgenthaler, the conversion of English laws into French. In Alberta, Lougheed resigns, replaced by Don Getty. The Keekster trial, very significant development. The trial, 3-month trial under Section 281, the first successful prosecution in English Canada, and set obvious precedent that they had no problem prosecuting Andrews and Smith of the Nationalist Party under that section of the criminal code. So there has been a precedent set, and the law was a lot tougher than people had originally thought. In BC, the Haidas, Indians, their land claims in Lyell Island, the banks, the Northland, and the Canadian CCB Bank. And I'm sorry, the CCB is out in Alberta, I'm sorry. In BC, we have also the forest fires, significant all over the summer. I don't know how significant. It's significant to people out there. Steve Fonio ends his run across Canada, Native Rights, Bligh Island, and Expo 86. Big thing in BC. Northwest Territories, NDP gets into power. And I think one of the big stories is AIDS. Now, the Mengele story is also big. The Mengele hoax, as some people would call it. A lot of other people say it's a death. I think that Bob Marshall has done a lot of work and research on that. Maybe he'll come in the next few days and deal with that one. And also the Aja case, the whole Bulgarian connection hoax. And now it's panning out into, or not now, it panned out into actually involving right-wing intelligence groups.
Well, you mentioned a good one off the top there, and that was the Gander Newfoundland. I think that that is another point that I missed in my comments, and that is I think that in 1985, more pages were added to the annals of airplane sabotage. And I think that Gander Newfoundland is another page to be added to that, and I think that we're going to see a lot more in the future of airplane sabotage. The public is not regularly, usually the public's mind when these planes crash is distracted to bomb-type sabotage. Of course, on the International Connection, we talked, did a very, very good segment with Sherman Skolnick, our source in Chicago, who talked about the Watergate plane and the electronic sabotage that took place there. I think that's just another example, like the Delta flight that crashed with 35 top IBM executives on board working on the SDI. when these planes crash, it isn't so important as to what caused the crash as to who's on board.
Quickly, why Gander? What does this have to do? Why? I mean, I can understand, you know, Samantha and maybe IBM officials and corporate warfare and that kind of thing. Why Gander? Why would Gander be sabotaged?
Well, as we don't know who was on that plane yet. Obviously, there were a large contingent of American military personnel, and they weren't all privates like Gomer Pyle. There were probably some very, very technical specialists and experts on that plane who were very worthwhile and important to the American fighting effort. And so when you're in a battle, if you can knock out some of your enemy's top personnel, it certainly helps down the road.
Who? Who? The Egyptian splinter groups that are opposed to the American role in the Sinai?
Oh, no, I don't necessarily think that the Egyptians were behind the Gander.
No.
The Gander.
That was the speculation in the press.
That was the speculation in the press, but I think that really we can't tell who yet until we do get more information, as I say, as to who was on board. But one thing is for certain, and that is that the cause of this accident, and when you look at the information released and the pattern at which the information came out, there's no doubt that there was a cloak in the minds of the authorities and a stonewall as to publicly talking about what really caused the accident. The shreds of evidence that they pulled out that the plane had had problems 2 years ago and a few years ago and this problem and that the reverse thrust may have gone. If you were to pull any aircraft off the line of Air Canada's or any airline, you could probably find, you would not probably, you will find the same sort of problems. To this date, they have not given one reason as to why the plane crashed, because they can't give a reason yet.
Quickly moving along, we're running out of time. Tom, let's go on pollution and Ross Dowson. Pollution important. A few weeks ago, it really hit home in the front pages of the press. We're living in one of the worst zones, globally speaking. And the Ross Dowson case. Basically, he's a socialist, and that socialism, revolutionary socialism, by means of parliamentary majority, is illegal in Canada. Let's deal with Dowson first. I think we should give a little history. 1977, NDP leader Stephen Lewis asked Attorney General Roy McMurtry if the RCMP had a presence in the NDP. Over a month later, McMurtry says, yes, they did. And 6 days later, socialist Ross Dowson launches a slander suit against the RCMP, who had circulated phony letters in his organization, the League for Socialist Action, during the 1970s. Now, the League for Socialist Action had suspected this. One of the reasons was because the RCMP had blackmailed a homosexual from Montreal, and they blackmailed the guy into spying on the League for Socialist Action. He felt bad about doing it, and he revealed himself to the League. But the key finding takes place in 1979, when the Creever Commission reveals Operation Checkmate, when the RCMP, they admit to forging letters. And then a few months later, the McDonald Commission, where the names of the officers are revealed, enabling Dowson and his lawyers to bring a suit against the specific officers. The RCMP, they say Mr. Dowson was committed to social revolution by violent means, if necessary, which Dowson denies. The RCMP says he had entered the WAFL, which is the left caucus of the NDP. It was formed in the early 70s in response to the encroaching domination of American capital in Canada. And the RCMP said that he was gaining influence in the NDP. I guess they were afraid that he would really bring them on a course of social revolution. Who knows what it was, but whatever it was, they felt it was a good enough reason to sabotage his organization. I asked his lawyer, Harry Capito, who were the RCMP after? What did they see their role as in the early 70s and 60s?
They saw their role as maintaining social stability, and they targeted all individuals that were effective in challenging the status quo. They infiltrated the Saskatchewan Federation of Labor. They infiltrated Native and Indian and Black groups. in my client's opinion, they had a very strong presence in the League for Socialist Action with numerous informants. They infiltrated. We believe that they really had a lot more influence in the WAFL and in the NDP than has come out. And my client has always taken the position that there's a big cover-up here that we can't get to the bottom of. What did the RCMP actually do in the NDP? Did they join it? Did they participate in the WAFL? Did they sit on the executive? What positions did they advocate? How could they justify this? And what was the reason why they were doing it? We know from open admissions from senior Privy Council officials that they kept an eye on the finances of the WAFL. We know from the same sources that they gained all kinds of information on personnel in the WAFL, on decisions, on the political activities and so on. And we know that that they prevented any kind of public hearing of what the RCMP did in the WAFL. It may be the McDonald Commission did hear evidence on this, but it was never made public, and we don't know. And it may well be that these lawsuits may open the door and tell us the truth about what's happened. It may well be that we've got a Watergate situation, but we don't know anything about it because there's been a real cover-up. It seems in the United States, it's much easier to get at the truth than in Canada. And it seems that in Canada, state officials and the government and the RCMP are all locked together, and they have seemed to function in such a way as to block the revelation of really what was going on there.
Very important stuff. A dark day for Canadian history from a civil libertarian standpoint. Tom, before we discuss this, I think I should just quickly summarize what happened. After 8 years of political battling, right up to the Supreme Court, as Mr. Capito said, a lot of people tried to stop it. He finally gained the right to sue the RCMP officers. They had confessed to doing all this stuff. I mean, they had already confessed the crimes. It was just he was actually suing the Queen, Her Majesty the Queen. Thomas,
I think that's of interest, because the Executive Intelligence Review really has shown in its documents that the Royal Canadian Mounted Police is really a branch office of British intelligence. So I think it would be wise of him to sue the Queen.
I'm sorry, Thomas, I was just on the telephone to a listener. But after 8 years of political battling, right up to the Supreme Court, they finally got it in small claims court, okay? And earlier this month, a decision was finally handed down, not guilty. Okay, the judge affirmed the illegality of socialism, that is the opinion of Mr. Dowson, when he remarked that in disrupting Mr. Dowson's activities, the RCMP were simply doing their jobs. And, well, what can we say? I mean, what do you think of the implications of that? I think it's a drift to statism. It's saying that the state can determine the political course, and then you have to ask yourself, who is the state?
Well, to begin with, pollution really emanates because of a weakening in the nation state versus the corporate body. The corporate citizens really spend as much on pollution as they have to. And to the degree that the nation states remain strong, the Canadian government remains strong, then they can force the corporations into spending more money on the cleanup. I would imagine that as the nation states, as I mentioned, begin to disappear and weaken, that we're going to see even more and more pollution, and we'll have nothing more eventually than a bunch of laws on the books and nobody to carry it out or enforce it.
Well, Tom, you've drifted. I wasn't quite the response I was hoping, but since we're running out of time, you have actually moved it towards pollution. So let's talk about pollution right now. Big story: workers' health. I mean, implications of workers suing for damages, PCBs. Who do you pin it on? Toxic compounds, their long-term health effects. Very complicated issues. Where did they come from? Important: St. Clair River. Significant. Hyde Park, I think, is a cogent microcosm of what's happening. Hyde Park, you've got dioxin sitting there. They're about to, from Hooker Chemical, they're about to seep in to Lake Ontario, destroy it permanently, make it unconsumable. And President Reagan is not, well, I don't want to use the label, but the Reagan administration really is doing nothing. Hooker Chemical is doing nothing. What kind of people are these you know, do they not care about the Great Lakes and the drinking water?
Well, the corporate citizens have very little wish to clean up and use shareholders' dividends and to clean up the mess that they make. They're rather irresponsible, most of all the corporate citizens. And unless they can be forced and shown that they will be brought into the courts and given heavy fines and made to pay for their wastes, they're not going to clean up at all. And, of course, this means that the nations and the governments have to be prepared to bring them to court. And, of course, that isn't going to happen because pretty well the in all the nations around the world, the leaders are brought into power via the corporations and the College of Corporations, and the military-industrial complex puts up millions of dollars and runs their candidates and gets their candidates into office. So how are you going to ask those men to all of a sudden turn around? Once in a while you'll get a principled man, but I don't think I see many around.
Very significant and good comment, Tom. I think maybe we have someone who's a little more principled right now in Ontario, a little more progressive than we've had in the last little while. I'm talking about the new Environment Minister under James Bradley. Certainly they don't point fingers at the business, and they're very diplomatic about, you know, who they refer to and very careful. But at the same time, they've showed a heck of a lot more commitment. They've made the Environment Ministry a much higher profile ministry. And
well, it seems to me that instead of funneling their money into cleanup, they're funneling it into public relations campaigns. That certainly doesn't help really with pollution, but it does help with your image of pollution.
That's a good point. We'll have to see the tangible results as they come.
Don't hold your breath, Dave.
Well, unfortunately, maybe it's a little too late. I asked Stan Gray, who worked at the Westinghouse plant for 12 years, where did they dump their PCBs?
The pollution, the environmental contamination everybody's complaining about, I mean, everybody focuses on the waste disposal companies and the truckers who are all the small fry, but who put it in there in the first place? There's a big electrical multinationals like Westinghouse and GE who just dumped that stuff. They knew they're not supposed to, but I thought everybody else planned, did it. It was the thing that was accepted, tolerated, instructed by the companies, and that's why you have so much problems with PCBs in the lake water and the milk. That's why you have it all over the environment, because it was not properly disposed of when it was used where transformers were manufactured.
Senior Liberal Policy Advisor Gary Gallen.
That leaves Ontario with approximately 6 million liters of PCBs in use today, with 1.5 million liters in storage. And one could suspect that there's at least that amount, if not more, having been dumped down the drains of Ontario into our waterways.
Who are the main offenders?
We don't know. We know that the main users are those companies that use electrical equipment, capacitors and transformers, large industries, pulp mills, and the utilities.
But it appears there's little the new government can do. The previous government failed to act in time, and under the Environmental Protection Act, there's a statute of limitations of 1 year, after which prosecutions cannot be laid. It's almost impossible to force companies to clean up Lake Ontario, because much of the waste entered through the city's sewers and drainage systems. And there are other obstacles, too.
There are some cases where neglect over a number of years has caused a major problem, such as at Pottersburg Creek in London, where the company alone does not have the financial resources to proceed.
Westinghouse doesn't?
Westinghouse Canada, that particular plant, doesn't.
Oh, is that what also happens, that even though it's a multinational, the company in the United States says we don't want to have anything to do with it, let them concern themselves with their particular problem?
Yeah, there is that kind of isolation that goes on, that kind of separation. That's our legal base. We can't, as a province, go across the boundary lines and go after the parent companies. We are in a position where there is significant PCB contamination across Ontario, to one degree or another. Certainly in the urban areas, the concentrations are higher. We're still finding PCBs coming down the Don and the Humber Rivers in Metro Toronto. So they are going to be with us for a long time. We find that the previous government did not act quick enough. And we now are going to act quickly. We have the public mandate who understood but the rigidity of 42 years in government had set in, and there was a need for a fresh government approach to a number of things, including cleaning up the environment.
You got to do is you got to force the government to enforce their own rules. You got to put enough pressure on them, either through action shop, source industry, also use the collective pressure of the unions and go to the political representatives of labor, which is the NDP, to pressure the government to crack down on the big companies. Government has been talking for years and years and years about having a cleanup bill that would make the big corporations that polluted pay the cost of the cleanup. And they ought to pay it in terms of what it takes to remove that stuff. They ought to pay some kind of indemnities or compensation fund to the victims of it. A lot of people have cancer, a lot of people have diseases, a lot of people have had defective children and other problems as a result of PCB contamination in the environment at work, and the government ought to force those companies to pay the price to hold them to account for the human damage they've caused.
That was Stan Gray, and that was taken, that was late July that we conducted that. Unfortunately, it's 12 o'clock noon. I have theater liftings. I hope it can be integrated into the next on-air person. But I will play Movie Time because it's a paid ad.
Movie Time is brought...